Today's topic is entitled The Centrality of the Land of Israel. Very relevant to the Parsha of Lech Lecha, and a very emotional topic, as we will see for many, in terms of if this obligates us at all, not only towards supporting the Land of Israel, but also in terms of going to live in the Land of Israel. In the Haftorah that we will read this week, there's one verse which says the following. It says, V'ata Yisrael Avdi Yaakov Asher Bechartikha Zera Abraham Ohavi. It says, you are Israel, my servant Jacob, who I have chosen. You are the seed of Abraham, my beloved, Abraham who loves me. Interestingly, we discussed God. Abraham as one who fears God, but here he's called the one who loves God. All right? Why is Abraham described as one who loves God? Well, we know, beginning with this week's Torah reading, that Abraham was given 10 tests that he had to go through in order to prove his worth, if you will, to God. And the first of those tests is in the beginning of this week's Parsha of Lech Lecha. As we know, God says to Abraham, Lech Lecha, go from your home, from your place of birth, from the place of your father to the land that I will show you, and it will be a blessing for you, and so on. And it's been pointed out by some, this is very interesting, that this is the first commandment ever given to a Jew. Right? Abraham, if we presume, is the first Jew, as we usually do. He's the patriarch of the Jewish people. The first command given to him is go to Israel. Lech Lecha, go to Israel. I think that should be significant, and if it's not significant enough to indicate how central Israel is to Jewish life, then really we can consider an even earlier source. And that is in Bereshit. As you know, the very opening of Chumash, Bereshit bar Elohim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. Rashi's very first comment upon this verse, very famous comment, Rashi brings the view of Rav Yitzchak. We don't necessarily know who this Rav Yitzchak is. Some say there's a source for it in Chazal, in our rabbinic writings. Rav Yitzchak says that really the Torah should have started not here, with Bereshit. What a chutzpah. You know, God says, I'm going to open with Bereshit. And the first comment of the Jewish people is in the famous words of Rashi, what did you start here for? What did you start here for? Why? Where should you have started? So Yitzchak says, you should have started in HaKodesh Hazeh Lachem Rashi Chodashim with the first commandment given to the Jewish nation as a whole. Not to a Jew as an individual, but given to the Jewish nation as a whole. Okay? And that commandment was HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem Rashi Chodashim, that this month shall be for you the first of months. The calendar that God gave the Jewish people as they were about to leave Egypt, this is the first mitzvah, Rashi says, that was given to the Jewish people as a whole. This perspective, in other words, presumed that isn't the Torah a book of law? If it's a book of law, it's to start with the first law that was given to the Jewish people. Why does it start with the idea that God created the heaven and the earth? And Rav Yitzchak answers, a very interesting answer, he says the reason it was done this way was for the purpose of the land of Israel, so that it could be given to the Jewish people. Because otherwise, when the time came after the Jews left Egypt, that they would go conquer the land of Israel. So what do you mean you're going to conquer the land of Israel? It doesn't belong to you. You're thieves. How can you just go take the land of Israel? And the answer is, Rashi tells us, because we can say it's not true. Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Therefore, he can give that earth to whoever he wants. Any part of that land he wants to give to another person, and to another nation, he can't. At first, he gave it to other nations. But then when the Jews became worthy of it, he took it from them and he gave it to us. So, the reason why the whole Torah started with Bereshit is because, again, of the importance of the land of Israel. That God would want to promise us the land of Israel and have it be given to us in a way that was acceptable to the nations, even though today, of course, it's still contested. But as a result, that's why he started the whole Torah with Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz. The whole focus from creation is the idea that Jews should dwell in the land of Israel. And again, Abraham is given that first command as his first test of his 10 tests. Now, I might point out, maybe we'll see this next week, there is somewhat of a debate concerning what the 10 tests were. Often you have in Judaism a tradition about a certain number, but we don't necessarily know each individual aspect of the number. For example, there are 613 commandments. We all know that. However, there is a big debate about what the 613 commandments are. One of them we will see in a second. Is there a mitzvah to dwell in the land of Israel? Is that one of those 613? We know there's 613, but if that's one of them or not, is going to be a debate. So here too, there are 10 tests that were given to Abraham, but there's a debate about what the 10 tests were. All right? Some say the 10 tests are based as well on midrashim, on things that are not exactly in the text but are part of our tradition. But others consider this, lech lecha, as I'm saying, to be the first of the tests. It's the first one that's indicated in the text itself. The first command given to Abram to go, to leave your people, to leave your family, to uproot yourself, and to go live in the land of Israel. Now, the last test, we're not going to go through all of them right now, but the last test given to Abram Avinu. Anyone want to suggest what the last test was? And some would say the most difficult. Yes? Okay, Akedat Yitzchak, right? Offering up Isaac as a sacrifice. Now, it is true there is one view, actually, the view of Rabbeinu Yonah, who holds that there was even another test after that, and that is after Sarah died, which was in result of her hearing about the sacrifice of Isaac. It says Abraham then had to find land for Sarah to be buried, and it was very difficult to find that land. So some say that was another test, but most hold that this was the most difficult test. Akedat Yitzchak, offering Isaac as a sacrifice. And I don't know if anyone knows, but can you tell me of any relationship in terms of style, in terms of the text, between this mitzvah we just saw that was given to Abraham of Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, you should leave your land, and that was the first test, right? And the last test of the Akedah. Does anyone know of any similarity between them? Okay, the answer is that when God tells Abram to sacrifice Yitzchak, he uses the same language. This is the only place this language is used. He says there also, Lech Lecha El Eretz HaMoriah. He says, take your son, your beloved son, the son you love, Yitzchak, the Lech Lecha, the same language, and go to the land of Moriah, which we know is where the Beit HaMikdash would be built, where the temple would be built, which is Jerusalem. The same exact language as the first test, Lech Lecha, uproot yourself and go to Israel, is also in the last test, uproot yourself and go to Har Moriah, to Yerushalayim, where Isaac will be offered as a sacrifice. So again, you see how significant this term Lech Lecha is. Go to Israel, go to Yerushalayim. Israel only has its full Kedusha, its full sanctity, our tradition tells us, when we also have Jerusalem, where the temple was, where God's presence would be most keenly felt. I might point out as well that with reference to this notion of Lech Lecha, very strange, Lech Lecha. What does it mean, Lech Lecha? It should have just said, if you know Hebrew, Lech. Lech Me'artzecha. This is a very strange language. Lech Lecha. Which literally means go to yourself. I mean, go to myself. He said go to Israel, not to go to myself. So I'd like to explain, my own explanation to this would be the following. That the Rambam in Hilchot Beit HaBichira, the laws of the temple, the Rambam explains the reason why the temple is built where it was is because of the history of that place. The Rambam says not only is this place where we offer sacrifices significant because of that, but this is the place, he says, going back in Jewish history, where, for example, Abraham, we said, offered Isaac. This is the place, he says, where Noah offered his sacrifice after coming out of the ark. That's what he says. He says this is where Cain and Abel offered their sacrifices. This is where Adam Arishon, the first human being, offered his sacrifice in thanking God for creating him and giving him life. He goes on to say that this very place is the ground from which the first human being was created. From that ground, from that dirt, right there at Har Moriah, where the place of the Beis HaMikdash is. That's where the world was created from. That's where the human being was created from that spot. So I'd like to suggest that when it says Lech Lecha, God's telling everyone, go to yourself, when he's telling them to go to Israel, he really means go to yourself. And he says it by Jerusalem too. Because that's where you were really created. You as a human being were created from this spot. Go to that place, then go into yourself by going there. That's where you are from. That's where you were created. Indeed, I've suggested that's why when a Jew goes to Israel, and especially to the Western Wall, that's why he feels so much. You know, he's so emotional. Even Jews who were not observant at all or nothing to do with Judaism, they go to the Western Wall and they start crying and they spend who knows how much time there. Why? What is it? What does it? Maybe they don't realize it, but this place they are intimately connected to. This is a place where they were created from. And thereby every Jew, and to some degree therefore every human being, relates this place. Maybe that's why the Palestinians want this place. They think it's because they have the noble sanctuary there, the Dome of the Rock. But it's really something else. It goes back to creation, that human beings were created in that place. Again, the Pope and others go to the Western Wall. They cry there. They put notes in. Why? Would I necessarily do that if I go to a Christian place? But this place has world significance from a spiritual point of view. Again, emphasizing the importance that it has for the Jewish people to some degree for all peoples. In the parsha of Lech Lecha, which we are discussing, so there is a sin that takes place according to the Ramban by Avraham Avinu. Abraham goes to Israel and almost immediately there is a famine that takes place. So Abraham goes down from the land of Israel, and he goes into Egypt, where there he encounters some trouble, and he is told, according to the Ramban says this was a mistake, that Avraham Avinu should not have left the land of Israel, the Holy Land of Israel. Once you are there, he should not have left it. This was actually a sin on his part, as we've explained many times in my classes at the shul. We were never afraid, our halakhic authorities and our commentators, to point out the weaknesses of our leaders in Klal Yisrael, of our patriarchs and matriarchs. We did not have a notion that people are perfect, be it Jesus, be it the Pope. We do not have a notion of people being infallible in our tradition, and our tradition points out when people have made mistakes. Avram should not have left, at least the Ramban says, from the land of Israel. And this gives us an opportunity to show as well the importance of this land that the Talmud points out. For example, it says that whoever lives outside of the land of Israel, that would be us, that individual, it's like he has no God. Or in another place it says in the Talmud, anyone who lives outside of Israel, it's like he worships idols. Of course, these things aren't to be taken literally. What it means is, because the land of Israel, it so happens, is a land, it says in the book of Dvarim, which God is always focusing upon. He always has his hashkacha, his personal involvement and governance over that land. He has his eye on that land more than any other land. So that's why in Israel you have a greater possibility to experience spirituality. Again, that's why we go to Israel and come back so excited, you know, and so saying we have such a spiritual experience that we do not have here. Because that land is something that gives that notion over and provides that atmosphere. So to live outside of Israel, it's as if, compared to what you could be having spiritually, it's as if you're worshiping idols. It's as if you are turning away from the greater experience of God for what you can get in the exiles. That's how it says that whoever walks, this is in the Gemara Ketubot, Daf Kuf Yud Aleph, whoever walks Dalet Amot, whoever walks 8 feet in the land of Israel, it's as if they have a place in the world to come. They get that reward. That's how holy it is just to even walk in the land of Israel. And to experience, you know, that moment. Some people, you know, get off the plane in Israel following some of the Talmudic sages and they kiss the ground when they get off the plane and then the land of Israel. The Ramban himself, who we pointed to as saying it was a great sin that Abraham did by leaving Israel, the Ramban says something really amazing. He says in the Parsha of Shema, the second Parsha of Shema, so there it says that after the Jews are exiled, it says, "Va'avadatem mehera me'al ha'aretz tova asher Hashem noten lachem, v'samtem et divrei ela al levavchem yamafshichem, u'kshartem otam liot ayetchem, v'ayu zavot bein enechem." It says that after the Jews are exiled, they should still put these words that they're being told from the Torah upon their heart. They should still wear tefillin. They should still put up mezuzahs. And the Ramban asks, what do you mean they should still Of course they should still do those things. Why? It's the Torah, isn't it? Well, of course they should still do those things. And the Rabban says, there's some controversy about what he says, but he says, and quoting a rabbinic text for it, I believe, that you might have thought that, you know, the only place you can really do mitzvahs is in the land of Israel. Who are you kidding? What, outside of Israel in the exile is a place to do mitzvahs? So the Torah tells us, continue to do mitzvahs anyway, even when you're outside of Israel. So that, the Talmud says, listen to this, not because, you might have said, because the Torah is relevant anywhere. So that, it says, you do not forget how to do them when you will one day come back to Israel. Again, it's almost like, according to the Ramban, the whole purpose of doing mitzvot is that they should be done in the land of Israel, in that place. How could one think that really mitzvahs should be done outside of Israel? Okay, yeah, keep doing them, keep it up, keep up the good work. But the ideal, you have to know, is that they should be performed in the holiest place on earth, in Eretz Yisrael. Let's move now to the question of a more practical issue, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the idea of living in the land of Israel. Are we obligated to go there, and are we just compromising by continuing to live in Cincinnati and to live in the United States? Rabbi Riskin once put it this way. Rabbi Riskin once said, when he was here giving a speech about the importance of living in Israel, he said, and I'll never forget it, he said, people who live in America tend to think that, you know, American Jewry is where it's at. Right? You know, you live in Cincinnati, you live in America, so many Jews in America. He said, you know what? He said, American Jewry, when the history of Jewry will be written, is just a little footnote to a chapter in a book on the history of the Jewish people. That's what American Jewry is. It's a little footnote. You know, people don't even always read the footnotes. That's how he put it. So all I'm pointing out is that, you know, when you're in the middle of something like here, you're in Cincinnati, United States, you think, yeah, this is the center of everything. But I know, and I often feel this way when I go to Israel, then you really feel very little. You know, you feel very humbled. Here, like wherever I go, even if it's out of town, I'll meet someone who knows me, Rabbi Balk, I've listened to your shiurim, oh, you were at YU, yeah, I know you, I know your relative, I know people in Cincinnati, something. I go to Israel, often no one knows me, and I'm like a nobody. It's the best, most humbling thing. You go to Davin and a Minyan in the morning, no one knows who you are. No one comes up to you and says, oh, yeah, where are you from, Cincinnati? They say, well, what's Cincinnati? So you know, suddenly you think they're going to say, oh, well, yeah, I know people in Cincinnati. Oh, sure. You know, no one knows Israeli there. It's up, but many don't. So it's a very humbling experience. We're all living here. We think this is the center of world Jewry to some degree. You know, it's America and it's Israel. But many think it's just Israel, it's not America. Should we all be living in Israel? The Ramban, who we indicated before, was the one who so strongly said that Avraham Avinu sinned when he left the land of Israel, and the one who said that, yeah, keep mitzvahs anyway outside of Israel, but really they were meant for Israel. The Ramban is the one who says, clearly, in both his commentary on the Torah and also in his commentary on the Rambam Sefer Mitzvot, that it is a positive commandment to live in the land of Israel. We should all be living in the land of Israel. In fact, he went to live in the land of Israel, even in his time. It was not easy to do. We should all be living in the land of Israel. That's the view of the Ramban, and most religious Zionists will quote this Ramban ad nauseum, you know, continuously to indicate that you should not be outside of Israel, you should be living in the land of Israel. However, the Rambam, Maimonides, he does not seem to count the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel as one of the 613 mitzvot. If you look there, he does not say clearly it's a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. And some want to say, a famous commentator, the Megillat Esther on the Rambam, suggests that the reason the Rambam does not count it is because the Rambam held that it was a mitzvah only that one initial time when Joshua went in with the Jewish people to conquer the land, that you're supposed to conquer it and then you're supposed to live there. And then maybe it should have been that life should go on forever that way, but because we sinned, so that mitzvah did not become an ongoing mitzvah. The Rambam only counts his mitzvahs if they're mitzvahs that will always be things that you can fulfill forever. In other words, he does count the laws of the sacrifices, because he says, okay, we don't have a temple today, but if we did, these sacrifices would still be mitzvot. Okay? But he says, Megillat Esther says, that the mitzvah of conquering and settling the land was only that one time. Once we were exiled, then that mitzvah did not apply anymore. It does not apply today, says the Megillat Esther in his commentary, that Jews are required to live in the land of Israel. So this is the view of, we're looking through views of the Rishonim. The Ramban said you have to live there. The Rambam, again, another early authority, says that according to the Megillat Esther, you're not required to live there. It's not necessarily so. My Rebbe, Rav Parnas, said that, in fact, you could understand the Rambam as saying that while it's not a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel, the reason he doesn't count it is maybe for another reason. Because maybe he holds that normative life should be in the land of Israel. Do I have to tell you it's a mitzvah to breathe? The Rambam didn't say it's a mitzvah to breathe. But if I don't breathe, I'm going to die. But did he have to tell you it's a mitzvah to breathe? Of course it's a mitzvah to breathe. That's a fundamental. You're supposed to live. Did he have to tell you it's a mitzvah to live? It's a mitzvah to live. It's obvious you're supposed to live. That's, everyone knows that. So some say the Rambam means, it doesn't have to tell you it's a mitzvah to live in Israel. It's more than a mitzvah. It's a fundamental belief of Judaism, as it were, that life is supposed to take place in Israel. In fact, that's why the Rambam does say in Hilchot Malachim, we are not allowed to leave the land of Israel. Why aren't you allowed to leave the land of Israel? If you don't have to go there, so then it sounds like it's not a big deal to live there, so why can't you leave? So no, again, people might say, no, the Rambam is saying it is a big thing. It is a big thing to be in Israel. It's just you should be there already. You don't have to go there. You're right, you should be there already. And once you're there, you're not allowed to leave the land of Israel. In fact, based on the Gemara of Avodah Zarah, Daf Yud Gimel, it says there are two things you're allowed to leave for. You're allowed to leave to study Torah, and you're allowed to leave in order to get married. Rav Herschel Schechter understands this to mean you're allowed to leave for things that are absolutely necessary for your life. Learning Torah, that's seen as a spiritual obligation and necessity to live. You have to learn Torah. In fact, the Gemara says that even if you have Torah in the land of Israel, but it's not your rabbi, your teacher. So like you went to classes in the land of Israel, and you say, well, you know, I can't find any teacher I like. I don't like the classes. Even though there's Torah, you're allowed to leave Israel because you're allowed to learn Torah on its highest level. Just like they say as well, you're allowed to leave to get married. What if you say, someone says to you, well, there are plenty of women in Israel, plenty of men in Israel. What do you have to leave to get married for? Find someone in Israel. But let's say, you know, you find someone outside of Israel you've been corresponding with, and she seems to be the right one. So you don't have to say, well, I have to find one in Israel. Sorry. No. For things like this that are so basic to life that you have to have the right partner, so then you're allowed to leave Israel for this. Now, the Rambam goes on to say, as opposed to Tosafot, Tosafot says that it's only these two things you can leave Israel for, nothing else. The Rambam says you can leave for any mitzvah. That's seen as a life-needed experience. For any mitzvah or for parnasa, in order to make a living, you can leave the land of Israel. That would explain, some say, why for many years in our history, people did not live in Israel. Because it was difficult to live there. The land was not built up. It was difficult to make a living there, to survive there. Even in our own time, there are people who make aliyah, but then they leave. And it's because they said they couldn't make it. They tried. They couldn't get a job. It's not so easy. So as a result, again, you see that there are reasons why you can leave Israel, but generally speaking, one is, according to the Rambam, not supposed to uproot himself from the land of Israel. Again, it might be, as some say, that you should be there. That is where Jewish life is supposed to be taking place. There's one other view in the Rishonim. In Ketubot Daf Kuf Yud Amud Bet, there's a famous view in the Tosafot known as the view of Rav Chaim HaKohen. He says also that there is no mitzvah to live in Israel in our time. Why? Because in his time, this is in the Middle Ages, it was dangerous to go to the land of Israel. Very dangerous to go to the land of Israel. How do you get there? Very dangerous. People trying to stop you and other countries taking over Israel every time. It's Islam taking it over, the Christians taking it over, all sorts of wars involved in the land of Israel then to even get there. So he says, because of this, there is no mitzvah in our time to live in Israel. It's too dangerous. You're not required to risk your life generally to do mitzvahs. It's too dangerous to do this. So therefore he said, you're not required to live in the land of Israel. That was his view of things. And he had another view. He also said, you can only live in the land of Israel if you are going to be religious enough that you're going to be careful about the extra mitzvahs that are in the land of Israel. You know, there are all these mitzvahs dealing with the land of Israel. Shemitah, the sabbatical year, and what you have to do with your crops, truma, maser, giving stuff to the poor, all these laws that deal with the land itself that we do not have outside of Israel. All right? So if you're on the level and you're really careful about keeping mitzvot, okay, maybe you could say, yeah, it's a mitzvah for you to go there. But maybe many people aren't so careful. They got enough mitzvahs as it is. And if they're not careful, they're going to be violating these commandments. And it turns out you're going to be a sinner in the land of Israel, not someone who's doing mitzvahs in the land of Israel. So again, Rav Chaim HaKohen therefore held that it's only, you know, for certain individuals perhaps that they should make aliyah. It's not necessarily for everyone to do. Getting now to the view of later authorities. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook took the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel to the ultimate extreme in the following ways. First of all, he says, you have to go with the Ramban. It should be, we should be living in Israel. It's a commandment to live in Israel. Next, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook says, it's not just a personal obligation. It's a national obligation. It's not just, should I live in Israel? What do you mean, should you live in Israel? We should all be living in Israel. In fact, he said that the current situation, this he said in the 1960s, 70s or so, the current situation that we have most Jews, and now it's tilting a little toward Israel now, you know, for the first time there are more Jews living in Israel today than in the rest of the world. The number is 6 million, by the way, interestingly. Now there's a tilt toward more Jews in Israel than in the rest of the world, but for many years it was not like that. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook says, the idea that most Jews live outside of Israel, he says, is a chil Hashem, is a national desecration of God's name. It makes it look like to the rest of the nations that God cannot, like, bring his people back. Here we get the land back. God says, look, I'm going to give you the state. Here you go. You've been waiting for thousands of years. Okay, you can all come back now. We say, no, we don't want to come back. Like, what, are you crazy or something? Tzvi Yehuda Cook says, Rav Tzvi Yehuda says, so what a crazy thing. The nations, see, the Jews don't even want to go back to their land. They don't even want it. Yeah, there's a small group who wants it, and they send money and Israel bonds and everything else. But many Jews just don't want to go back. He considered this the ultimate desecration. And he said, however, that this is not surprising, because throughout Jewish history, Jews have always tended, especially in this last century, they have many times tended to find that they can get comfortable where their nation is, where they live. You know, we would say today in Borough Park, or in Teaneck, or even in Baltimore, or even Cincinnati. And in Europe, it was in Berlin, or in Vilna. You know, you can get very comfortable there and say, isn't life wonderful? We got so many yeshivas, so many great rabbis. Oh, Israel's not even on our mind even. Even though we say every day, we turn our eyes toward Jerusalem every day, three times a day. We dive in toward Jerusalem and toward the Beit HaMikdash. We need Eretz Israel. Everything's nice and beautiful. Who needs it? So Rav Cook said, and he brought proof to show this, that if you say this, he quotes first the Meshech Chochmah. The Meshech Jew thinks that Berlin is his Jerusalem, that a raging storm will uproot him by his trunk. A tempest will arise and spread in roaring waves and swallow and destroy and flood forth without pity that people. He lived before the Holocaust. And this is what he said would happen if people made Berlin into their Jerusalem. Others said the same thing. The Vilna Gaon warned the Jewish people, he said, if they do not return to Israel on their own accord, then God will return them his way, if they don't choose to go. And so the Jews, either they can go on their own, or if they don't go on their own, then they're going to have to be coerced to go. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook quotes these authorities to say, of course, it's very hard to say, what you mean, the Holocaust was God's plan? You mean he wanted to do that, to uproot the Jewish people? So Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook says, yes, the Holocaust was a necessary, his word, amputation in the exile to uproot the Jewish people and get them back to the land of Israel. In fact, he says that, for him, again, very controversial, but that's why the Holocaust occurred, according to him. Some people said it occurred, we've discussed this before, to the other extreme. Some people, we'll get to in a moment, the Satmar Rav said the Holocaust occurred because Jews went back to Eretz Yisrael. They shouldn't have gone back. You have to wait for the Messiah. That's the view of the Satmar Rav. Can't start building up the land of Israel again. We'll get to that in a moment. So Rav Yehuda Cook says just the opposite. It's because the Jews didn't go to the land of Israel in force. That's why we got punished as we did with the Holocaust. It was a message. You happy here in Berlin? You happy where you are in Poland and Hungary? You're not going to be happy for long. Get out of there. That was the message of the Holocaust. But Tzvi Yehuda Cook said all Jews should be living in the land of Israel. And his father of Cook, several years before the Holocaust, and in the year 1934, right before everything let loose in Germany, said Rav Cook, of Tzvi Yehuda Cook's father, the great Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cook, if there will cease the holy fervor and the desire for exalted redemption which stems from it, and if the natural human feeling for nationality and yearning for the honorable life of the nation disappear, the enemies of Israel will come and blow a shofar in our ears which will call for our redemption. They force us to hear the voice of that shofar. They will sound an alarm and set off a cannon in our ears that will not allow us to rest in the exile. This shofar will be the shofar of an impure beast. What is Hitler if not that description? It will be the shofar of an impure beast, and it will transform one day into the shofar of the Mashiach. Amalek, Hitler, and others like them awaken the redemption. And he who didn't want to hear it because his ears had become blocked, he will hear it. And out of absolute coercion, he will listen. This is Rav Cook in 1934. Is that amazing or what? Previous news history, you could have said, well, where are we supposed to go? There's nothing there. But now you're getting a homeland. Everything seems to be going that way. And now you still don't go. Okay, wake up, people. All right, this is the view of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. Again, middle view I'm going to give you now is that it's not an absolute mitzvah to live in Israel. It's called, Rav Moshe Feinstein says in his writings, or Soloveitchik believed, a mitzvah kiyumit. You're not obligated to live in Israel, but if you live in Israel, you will certainly be fulfilling a mitzvah. I don't know if you recognize this or not, but not every mitzvah is an obligatory mitzvah. There are mitzvahs that if you do this, you fulfill a mitzvah, but you're not required to do it. I'll give you a famous case which is somewhat laughable and somewhat tragic, if it really happened. Rav Eliezer Silver, the chief rabbi of Cincinnati, once was giving a lecture about divorce. And he said, and we know it's one of the mitzvahs of the Torah, that a person should get a get, should get a bill of divorce. And it is. It says in the Torah, if a person wants to separate from his spouse, so he has to give his wife a bill of divorce. And that's counted as a mitzvah, to go through this process. But there was someone in the crowd who heard Rabbi Silver say this, and for many years he had marital problems, and he never got divorced, because he figured, like, you know, it's a mitzvah to be married. You know, it's a good thing to stay married. Divorce is not a good thing. But then he heard Rabbi Silver say, you know, it's a mitzvah to get divorced. And this guy didn't understand that he meant, if you are going to get divorced, you go through the process. So he went home, and apparently then he got divorced. He got a bill of divorce, because Silver said it was a mitzvah. I never knew it was a mitzvah. I've been holding off for years, going for counseling. I never knew it was a mitzvah. Living in the land of Israel, so these you say, you know, if you live there, you're fulfilling a mitzvah. You're not required to do it. Rav Moshe Feinstein indeed did not live in the land of Israel. Soloveitchik did not live in the land of Israel. They're not required to live in the land of Israel. In fact, it's not brought down in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, that one is required to live in Israel. It's only said there incidentally in regards to certain other halachas, like if a husband wants to go to Israel, his wife doesn't, can he make her go, or should she go? Let's say, per se, there's a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. So this is the middle view. We have the extreme view. Yes, everyone should be living in Israel, and it's a national desecration that the whole nation is not. We have this middle view that it's not obligatory. It's a nice thing. And now the view of the Satmar Rav we mentioned before, who held, and others held like him, the Minchat Elazar, that it is not a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. Certainly it's not a national obligation to live in Israel. In fact, just the opposite. It's a national obligation that you should not live in the land of Israel. You see how Judaism is so beautiful? You have such a plurality of views, it is unbelievable. The Safa Rebbe says just the opposite of Rebbe's for Yehuda Cook. It's a national obligation not to live in the land of Israel. It's a desecration, what Zionism has done, he holds, and the fact that people live now so much in the land of Israel. Why? Because he believed you're not allowed to go back to the land of Israel until the Messiah comes. You have to wait around. You're not allowed to go. What is this based on? The Minchas Elazar, like the Sefer Rav, the Minchas Elazar, who was known as the Munkatcher Rebbe, he says that we say in the davening, Nechata'enu galinu me'atzenu. We were exiled from our land, right, because of our sins. You're not supposed to just go back. You're supposed to live in exile. Your status as sinners, then that's your punishment. You're supposed to be living in the exile. You're not supposed to go back to the land of Israel. Okay? So this whole idea that you went back and created a state, this is against God's will. You are not supposed to go back to the land of Israel until the Messiah comes, and because he's the anointed one, and he's chosen by God, and he's supposed to fix everything, you can follow him to go back. Ben Gurion was not the anointed one, or they would say, or Herzl, or whatever, according to this view. They weren't observant. They weren't committed to Judaism. So, according to this view, this was a mistake that the Jews went back to the land of Israel. Jews are supposed to be living in the exile, and when they repent, then God willing, they will go back. He bases this upon a midrash from Shir HaShirim, which the Gemara in Masechet Ketubot Daf Kuf Yud Aleph expresses as follows. The three oaths, three famous oaths. The first was that the Jews are not allowed to take over the land of Israel by force. In other words, the deal was that God made an agreement that I'm exiling the Jews. But I mean, there's got to be an agreement here, or they'll just get wiped out in the exiles. So, number one, the deal is the Jews, you're not allowed to go and try to take over Israel by force. Got to wait till I say it's time. The number two agreement is that you're not allowed to rebel against the nations. And number three is the deal with the nations is that they can't afflict the Jewish people too harshly. Because God says, I can't expect my people to stay in the exile if they're just going to be attacked nonstop. I mean, that's not a fair deal. They have to be able to live a decent life. So those were the three oaths. The Sefer Rebbe says, because there's those three oaths, so you see it says, you're not allowed to go back and take the land of Israel. So he says, so that's why the Jewish people who go back are sinners. That's why Zionism, he says, is the work of the evil inclination, of the Satan, of the devil, if you will. That's why you have these Niturei Karta to the ultimate extreme, this group who are friends with Yasser Arafat, and this group who goes to Iran to visit the president of Iran, who says he wants to wipe out the state of Israel, and they say, we're with you. We're with you. Because we believe there shouldn't be a state of Israel. It wasn't supposed to happen. They believe the redemption will come about when the state of Israel is broken down and the Jews are back out in exile, then maybe the Messiah will come as he was supposed to. What we're doing now is interfering with the messianic process. See how they believe it? One group holds, so Yehuda Cook holds that this adds to the messianic process. We got Israel back, we got Jerusalem back. Don't you see? Are you blind? Don't you see the way it's going? Next we're going to get the temple and rebuild it. Don't you see? And they say just the opposite. You see what's going on? This is interfering with redemption. They go back to the land of Israel. It says in the Talmud, you're not supposed to go back. This is interfering with the Messianic age. Wow. How you can take one event and look at it so many different ways. And with such extremes. It's just absolutely unbelievable. So the Sefer Rebbe says that you're not allowed to go back. How do we deal with the sins of the Sefer Rebbe? Anyone want to suggest, according to our perspective, how could we go back to the land of Israel, according to what he says? We had the three oaths that were taken. How come those oaths perhaps would not have any meaning today? Anyone want to suggest why? Why would those oaths have no meaning?
Number one, the nations of the world aren't
leaving. Number one, the nations of the world did not leave Israel alone with the Holocaust. It said they weren't allowed to afflict us too terribly. Well, if that wasn't too terribly, what is? So hello, the three O's, forget it. They're no longer relevant. They didn't keep their bargain. The three O's don't apply. Moreover, it says that we couldn't rebel against the nations. We didn't. The United Nations voted for it. We didn't rebel against them. They voted in favor of it. They could have voted against it. The partition plan, everything else, the Balfour Declaration before that. There was a national, an international type of movement for the Jewish people to go back to the land of Israel. So thereby, one cannot say that these three oaths still hold, and that would be the attack against the Satmar Rebbe. And by the way, also, as pointed out by many, Mefarshim Rav Aharon Soloveitchik and others, that this... the three oaths are not brought down in any halachic source. It's not brought down in the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam. In other words, there was an idea. No one brings this in Jewish law. You're not allowed to go back to Israel because of the three oaths. No one brings this down. So you see that this is not the halachic way that we follow things today. And again, that's why there is still room to say that one is allowed to go back to Israel. Also, I should add that the idea that the Munkatcher Rebbe said, Minchas Elazar, that it's a punishment to be in the exile. You're not allowed to go back. You're going against the punishment. Also, we can answer that up. For example, Noach, we just read about Noach, right, in the Parsha. Noach, it's, according to our tradition, was very technologically minded. He created the plow. What do you mean he created the plow? It was said that it's a punishment to the human beings that they had to plant everything in earth with their hands, right? It's going to be difficult for them to plant and to harvest and everything. And Noah goes around and creates the plow. Isn't that going against what God wanted you to do, to dig and to really sweat? And said you make it easier, you invent the plow. No. Because the answer is, if God wanted us to still do that, then he would have made it the plow won't work. It's okay. If it works, you're allowed to try to overcome it. But a woman in childbirth, it says you're going to go through pain in childbirth. So why are you allowed to have an epidural? Then we should say, according to Jewish law, you can't have an epidural. Sorry, you've got to go through the pain. Don't you see? It says you have to go through the pain. God says there's going to be pain in childbirth. Okay? No, the point is, if you can overcome it, you're allowed to overcome it. If you're supposed to have pain, God will still give you the pain. Don't worry about it. Okay? You'll still have it. And you still do, we know, women are in childbirth. You're allowed to overcome illnesses as well, right? You can't say, well, this illness must be from God. God wants to punish the person. Even if he does, there's still a mitzvah in the Torah of rapo yirapeh. You're supposed to try to heal the person. If God wants him to die, don't worry, he'll still die. But you're supposed to do everything you can to try to heal the person. So because of all this, we say that one is allowed to, in fact, to still believe in the mitzvah of living and going back to the land of Israel. And let me finally add the idea of burial in Israel. Just again, we've been discussing life in Israel. What about burial in Israel? I should add that this is somewhat controversial. We know Yaakov asked to be buried in the land of Israel. Yosef, his bones were taken, right, and carried from Egypt to the land of Israel. So on the one hand, it seems like one should be buried in the land of Israel. The Gemara says, in fact, that it's better to be buried in Israel than outside of Israel, because when the time of the Messiah comes and the bodies are going to go back for the resurrection in Israel, so if you're outside of Israel, you have to do Gilgul. You're going to have to roll, like, through the ground, you know, and it's going to be very painful to get there. All right. Where if you're in Israel, you just kind of stand up. I'm here. So finished. So it's better to be in Israel when that time comes. So it seems from that you should be buried in the land of Israel. The Tzitz Eliezer and others are those who hold that yes, you can be buried in the land of Israel, and that seems to be our custom. However, you should know Rav Moshe Feinstein, when someone asked him, while he didn't go around telling people not to be buried there, when someone did ask him once, should he be buried in the land of Israel? He said, no, you should not be buried in Israel. Why not? You didn't live there. You don't get to be buried there. Because the land of Israel says, excuse me, someone who lived here, you know, if you will, who fought for me, he gets to be buried here. Oh, you guys, you enjoyed your whole life in Borough Park? In Cincinnati? Oh, now you come. Oh, now you're dead. Oh, now you want to be in Israel. Oh, when we needed help here fighting the wars. Oh, when we needed your economy to help us out. Oh, but now. So this view kind of says, no, you have no right to live in the land of Israel. Not so happens, Rav Moshe Feinstein was buried in the land of Israel. How did that happen? Because Rav Henkin and others, other great Gedolim also said that the land of Israel would absorb someone who was a great tzaddik. In other words, you or me to say, no, you lived outside of Israel, well, you get to come now suddenly and be buried here and watch and look at Jerusalem, huh? No, you don't get to. Oh, but if you're telling me this great tzaddik lived in Israel, outside of Israel, Lubavitcher Rebbe, whoever it was, because he was trying to spread Torah and help people, and if that's the case, okay, so that the land of Israel will accept. That it will accept. So that's why we are lenient to bury great sages there, even though many great sages, the Lubavitcher Rebbe or Soloveitchik, were not buried there. Soloveitchik's buried in Boston, where he lived. Silver is buried in Cincinnati, where he did his work. The Lubavitcher Rebbe buried in New York, outside New York. Not buried in the land of Israel. So it's not so simple that this is the view necessarily that one takes, that one should be buried in the land of Israel. My wife tells me that she's going to be buried in the land of Israel, so I have no choice. Just like she's told me everything what to do until this day, so too. In closing, we've seen that Eretz Yisrael certainly has significance in terms of its greatness of a mitzvah of living there if you can. From the beginning we said Lech Lecha, the first mitzvah given to a Jew. The whole Torah starts with the idea of Eretz Yisrael being given to the Jewish nation. According to Rashi, that's why it starts as it does. There's no doubt there is greater possibility for an intimate relationship with God in the land of Israel than outside of Israel. You even feel it on a visit, even on a short temporary time there, it is the case. My teachers have now moved to Israel because they see this as a place where maybe they should be at least now, if not beforehand. And it is the greatest merit if you have children or grandchildren living there. I pray that I should have children and grandchildren living in Eretz Israel if I'm not there myself. And one day, that's where the redemption will take place. May it come, b'mheira b'yameinu, quickly and in our day.